In Canada, an act of violence against women occurs once every 6 minutes. 62% of those attacked are physically injured. Think about this as you're listening to this radio program.
The wall beside my head, and I try to draw the line, but it ends up running down the middle of me most of the time. And boys get locked up in some prison, girls get locked up in some house, and it don't matter if it's a warden or a lover or spouse. Just can't talk to them. No, you just can't reason. You just can't leave, and you just can't
leave. On December the 6th, 1989, Marc Lepine walked into L'École Polytechnique in Montreal and shot 14 women to death before killing himself. His intent was clear. Lepine hated feminists and blamed the presence of women in his engineering school for his problems. The victims were young, intelligent women and guilty of nothing more than belonging to the wrong gender in their killer's eyes. The effects of this event ran deep, not only throughout the communities in Montreal, but also across the country. We recognize the Montreal Massacre every year to remind ourselves that violence against women still persists and to reaffirm our struggle against it.
Let them die poor, I was locked into being my mother's daughter. I was just eating bread and water, thinking nothing ever changed.
We spoke to many people active around the issues of violence against women to evaluate where the situation stands at today and also to highlight the struggles against it. Here at CKUT, we remember the victims of the Montreal Massacre, as well as the women who daily experience violence in their lives, and we will not let their voices go unheard. As well, we will focus on what men can do to help stop gender violence.
Makes me crumble like the plaster where you punch the wall beside my head, and I try to draw the line, but it ends up running down the middle of me most of the day.
The Montreal Massacre may be particularly significant because of the time of year at which it occurred, being December the 6th. As people flock to the shopping malls for the holiday season, rarely do we think of the violent messages that the toys and video games we buy are conveying. I remember the first time I heard of the Montreal Massacre. I was 6 years old. My mother had taken me Christmas shopping with my brothers. Searching the aisles for my dream present, my mind filled with desire as my eyes finally fell on it. A toy automatic rifle. Wow. I ran back to my mother and enthusiastically begged for it. Being a native Montrealer herself, a somber look came over her face. "Do you know what just happened in Montreal?" she asked. And then she told me. The same somber feelings come across many others in the Montreal community around this time of year. We will now look back to 1989. This footage was taken from women calling into an episode of CKUT's very own Dykes on Mics, just days after the massacre took place.
It's interesting. It's December and this is high Christmas shopping season, and I've just been walking around and getting flyers in the mail, and you can see from day one what toys the little boys are supposed to play with and what toys the little girls are supposed to play with, you know. And it just sickens me to see children of 3 and 4 years old on television asking their mothers to buy them, you know, all these guns and toys and things that explode. And I think that has something to do with these types of killings. And I agree with Jean that it's not just these sicko wackos who are dismissed from mental institutions or who have family problems. It's ordinary people. It's people with good jobs, people with good lives, people with good family backgrounds. It could be anybody.
I think it's something unbelievable in our society that something like that is happening. I cannot understand it. I'm trying to understand it, but I'm especially trying to understand the violence inside the men. Why the men particularly?
No, but the men killer was a fool, was very sick, you know.
Yes, the thing is that, is it the reflect of a society, of the men in a society, or is it an isolated act?
This is isolated act is not the phenomenon of society. It's impossible. It will be in the war. That was the phenomenon of society. My opinion.
Yeah, but who makes the war?
A man is sick, that's all, you know.
I disagree. I don't feel that it's an isolated act. I feel as if it happened to myself. And I keep feeling as if I or my daughter was in that room. I keep seeing those girls. And I feel that what this man did, he was a maniac, but it's just a magnification of what is happening to women all the time.
To get a better idea on the conceptual framework that surrounds gender violence, I spoke with Margaret Delaurier. Margaret is a professor of philosophy at McGill University. She also teaches a course on feminist theory. The first question I wanted to ask was, a lot of the media that came out around December the 6th, 1989, that I've been looking at tended to paint Marc Lépine as kind of the lone gunman, and this being an isolated incident. And what I was wondering was, well, since then, the women's movement has challenged that idea that this was an isolated incident. And what I guess is the problem with looking at these cases as being kind of the acts of lone gunmen, so to speak?
Well, first of all, I should point out that at the time, that is in 1989, feminist commentary remarked on the way in which the events were depicted as politically uninteresting and simply an isolated incident. So I don't think it's so much feminist since 1989 as feminist at the time as well as since then. Marc Lépine in particular, of course, expressed hatred for feminists in particular, and feminist commentators then and now think that that's pretty clearly a political opinion he's expressing rather than a personal opinion. So construing acts of violence against women, whether they happen in private places or, as in the case of December 6th, in a public place, construing them as isolated incidents is removing them from the political realm, viewing them as personal interactions between two people, or in that case, one man and a bunch of women.
Well, terminology that's been used to describe these kind of events is put it in something like a war on women. Do you agree that there is a war on women?
Well, I agree. I mean, war is a technical term and usually involves an explicit announcement. And of course, there is no explicit announcement, and that itself is important. But I do think that there is a systematic practice of violence and threats of violence against women. Yeah.
Would you say that society encourages violence against women?
I think it's quite clear that commercial advertisements and many cultural artifacts, so many films, many television programs, many works of literature depict women as objects for the sexual consumption of men, and that sets women up for violence, yes.
Since you're a feminist theory professor at McGill, I was wondering, maybe you could speak a bit to how a feminist theoretical approach to this problem would be useful, maybe even more useful, let's say, than a law and enforcement approach or another kind of approach.
Well, I think that thinking philosophically, so thinking theoretically about the problem of violence is not to ignore the facts of the matter, not to avoid interest in the empirical cases, but is to precisely to think about them in a political context. So what I think is useful about thinking philosophically about violence against women is it allows you to think through just what the object of the violence is, just what motivates the violence, and what sorts of political ends are achieved by perpetrating violence, what the fear of women does to women, how it limits their lives, and how rethinking that fear and how to act on it in different ways might actually free women more rather than restrict them more.
Maybe you could just elaborate a bit on the point of fear. I mean, what kind of fear are we talking about when we say the fear that women are experiencing?
Well, I think most women are afraid of sexual assault. I mean, particularly afraid of strangers, but often quite rationally also afraid of their partners or possible partners or ex-partners. And one thing that does to women is make them more compliant to male demands of all sorts. So addressing the fear is extremely important in allowing women to take some measure of control over their own lives and to feel better able to establish their own projects and pursue their own projects rather than simply complying with what men in their lives think is important.
I don't think it's possible for a woman to say, no, I've never been, you know, harassed walking down the street. It doesn't matter what your age, your size, your race, anything. It's not, you know, it's not a personal thing. It's because you're a woman, and that's the only reason.
And it's really, really sad and scary for me, because, like, I want to go out at night, you know, and, like, just to walk to the store at the corner, you know, and just to do that is, like, I have to, like, totally change, wear the cap, put the big coat on, just because of the fear, you know, of a guy coming up or just attacking me or anything, and that really bothers me, because I don't feel any girl should have to go through that, you know, and it's really...
Right now, I have to say that I am fearful of the everyday man on the street, and I'd like to think that someday women will be able to feel safe in the streets.
You're always sort of being warned, you know, don't trust, you know, certain people, and because, you know, it could be the most normal person that you know, it's so hard to figure out who should I trust and who shouldn't I.
To debunk some of the myths that surround violence against women, I spoke with Megan Thurston, who works with McGill Women's Union at McGill University. One of the things that I've been talking a lot about with people throughout this is that the Montreal Massacre has kind of popularized this idea that it's strangers mm-hmm. a lot of the times that are committing acts of violence against women, and the problem isn't so much, you know, within the home or with people, you know. How do you feel about that?
I guess that's actually perhaps the greatest misconception concerning the Montreal Massacre. It's easy to say that the Montreal Massacre was an isolated event, that it was the act of someone who was crazy, insane, that it doesn't reflect how society socializes men in particular to control women to commit acts of gender-based violence. Certainly, the status of women in Canada indicates that, I mean, 50% of all women will experience some sort of physical or sexual or psychological violence against them after the age of 16, and domestic violence, domestic homicide is so prevalent still. So the Montreal Massacre, well, it does say that, yes, a stranger can commit an act of violence against a woman, an act of gender-based violence. It doesn't say that acts of violence against women are only done by strangers. Certainly, it's widely documented that, you know, people who women know, who are their relatives, their husbands, their friends, their boyfriends, commit acts of violence against women. So it's not an isolated event.
Would you say it's easier for people to believe that it is a problem in terms of it, you know, being a problem with strangers?
Well, in terms of upholding the system where husbands, boyfriends, that's just an example, can commit acts of violence against women, it's important for people to think that it's just strangers, because then we don't address the fact that women are suffering at the hands of people that they know, that they love, that, you know, this is the problem, is when we do consider it just as sort of an isolated event, someone who you didn't know, and not that that doesn't happen. I mean, there are countless incidences of strangers committing violence against women, but that does not mean that this is not happening within the home to a very large extent.
One of the greatest dangers of gender violence might actually be the way it is being presented to the public, or more specifically, to men. To get a feel for how much men actually know about the issue, I conducted some interviews with random men of all age groups around the McGill neighborhood. What is scary is how little some men know, or how much they think they know. Listen. So, to what extent do you think that violence against women is a problem right now in North America?
I don't know. Not too bad, I don't think. I don't really know.
I don't know. I don't know if it's a big issue. I know it's an issue, but I don't know how big it is.
I think it's a problem. To what extent? I think it's probably a pretty big problem. I think there's some subtle dimensions of the problem which are not usually taken into account either in terms of perception of men and women.
I have no idea. I don't know enough about it to say whether it's changing or not. I don't.
In North America, I don't think it's so much of an open thing as it is a societal thing that's like inherent in the gender relations, but it's definitely not as obvious as it is in some other countries, but it still exists definitely, even though there is like progressive change going on.
I think it's a problem in North America, but throughout the world too, you know, it is a major problem.
I don't necessarily see it as a problem, but I see it as more an issue that has localized appearances. It happens to some people, but not to most, but it can be varying degrees of importance for certain people.
From what I've seen, from my experience, I don't know all that much, but from what I've heard, it's like a bigger problem. I know people, especially in Montreal, they're like, girls are afraid to walk around the city, and that's kind of a big problem. That means it is a big problem. I'm not too sure.
It's not that much of a problem as it is in other countries. It's pretty toned down in North America right now.
What other countries would you say it's worse in?
Mostly the Arabic countries right now, and perhaps Eastern Europe too.
It has existed in most societies, I think. It existed in our own civilization, in Rome, in Greece to some extent, and it has existed in spite of the advent of Christianity and so on.
Don't do crystal. Don't do boys. Don't do boys who do crystal. Don't do crystal boys. Don't do crystal. Don't do boys. Don't do boys who do crystal. Don't do crystal boys.
What advances would you say have been made in the last 14 years since this has happened in terms of challenging the problem of violence against women, either in terms of a conceptual framework or in terms of addressing the problem itself?
Well, there's much more public discussion of violence against women as a political problem. That's a good thing. I think that there have been advances in viewing domestic abuse in particular as socially unacceptable, but not nearly enough is done to actually help women who are abused at home. So I don't know that I can be extremely optimistic in what I say about this. It seems to me some very limited advances have been made, mostly with respect to our willingness to discuss violence against women publicly, to some extent our willingness to see domestic violence in particular as wrong, but I think there is still a great willingness to see men who abuse women as motivated by strong and passionate feelings for those women that are understandable, rather than as motivated by a desire to control women.
And finally, since the facts show us that more often than not it is men who are carrying out acts of violence against women, where would you put the role of men in dealing with this problem?
Well, I think that there are all sorts of things that men can do to make the point that women ought not to be subject to the control of men in particular. So men can make a point of being respectful when women speak. Men can make a point of allowing women to be angry without reacting to that anger as a personal affront. Men could do concrete things to help women who want to be activists in working against violence, and men can of course organize other men in anti-violence programs.
I've been subject to the same destruction of desire from the same effect.
Again, that was Professor Margaret Deloria you just heard from. One group that has been instrumental in organizing men to fight violence against women is the White Ribbon Campaign. I'm joined on the phone right now with Jack Gagliardi, who is with us from Toronto, and he works with the White Ribbon Campaign. So I was wondering if you could give us a bit of background on what the White Ribbon Campaign is.
Sure. White Ribbon began in 1991 after a rash of murders and rapes here in Toronto, and just a handful of men felt that there weren't any male voices out there, that men weren't really speaking out against this, even though it was happening, you know, in our streets. And they decided that men needed to say something. So they decided to put together a White Ribbon Campaign where, you know, the ribbon would be a man's pledge never to commit, condone, or remain silent about violence against women. And it took off across the country.
Mm. And, of course, the focal point for the campaign is centered around December 6th, which is the anniversary of the Montreal Massacre.
Well, the actual campaign is certainly, it runs from November 25th leading up to December 6th. But what happened in 1989 was just one of the various things that encouraged these men to get involved. Many people think that White Ribbon is about the December 6th commemoration. It certainly is, but we actually ask men to stand back on that day on December 6th and really listen to the voices of women doing their work.
Why do you feel that, though, it is important to look at December the 6th?
Well, certainly it's one of those days in Canada that brings people together around the issue of violence against women, and White Ribbon definitely participates in that. To White Ribbon, it's really a time to start listening to women. You know, we should be doing that all the time, but on December 6th, we ask men to really think about supporting women's groups who are doing work on that day and reflect on their own attitudes and behaviors about women. So definitely it's a focal point for the campaign, but specifically White Ribbon activities usually don't happen on that day.
I think there's kind of an interesting dichotomy around the debate. It certainly came up around December the 6th, 1989, in terms of whether or not this was, that act in particular was an isolated incident, or whether or not it was part of a culture that promotes violence against women.
Sure.
And I was wondering, which side you were more inclined to believe.
Sure. Well, I mean, certainly we have a lot of men who will call up the campaign or email us and say, you know, hey guys, you know, this really has nothing to do with me because, you know, I don't beat my wife. I don't, you know, verbally abuse her. I don't do this kind of stuff. So what does this have to do with me, you know? And, you know, what happened in Montreal was just a crazy man. So, you know, why are you making such a big deal out of it? Obviously, White Ribbon believes that, you know, violence is on the continuum. You can, you know, go anywhere from, you know, sexist jokes all the way up to what happened in Montreal. And all of it is a form of violence against women. And when women have been telling us that they've been experiencing that kind of violence in one form of another or another, you know, men have to listen. You can't deny that that's the case. And in terms of Montreal and December 6th, we see that as just an extreme version of what happens to women every day.
Mm. And I mean, many people can agree that violence against women, physical violence, is completely unacceptable. I mean, that's generally something that goes without debate. But it seems to me that, I guess, the bigger problem is confronting some of the more subtler forms of violence that might exist. And I was wondering, I mean, how your campaign deals with those subtler forms of violence as well.
Well, one of the big things that we do in the summer is called Dad Walk. And it's an event where we encourage fathers to come out with their children as well as their partners and walk, showing that they want to be role models to the young boys in their life. And of course, that includes loving their mother, and we believe by getting to kids at a young age, things like sexist language, sexist jokes, traditional stereotypical ideas of what it means to be a man and a woman will be discussed and will be challenged, so that later on this inequality between men and women won't be as present as it is today. And we think that's really important, is to start teaching young people, you know, the subtler points of gender inequality, so that they know how to recognize it and they can change their attitudes and behaviors. So, in that way, I think it's really important.
What successes has the campaign had so far?
Certainly, we're distributing more ribbons and educational materials each year. The campaign is growing. We've had a lot of celebrity support too, which is, it doesn't necessarily have to be important because celebrities are on board with your campaign, but they have been showing that kind of support, saying we really understand the need to get this issue out into the mainstream. So we've been really successful in having that kind of support, and we're really happy about that. There have also been over 20 campaigns that have sprouted around the world thanks to, this small little Canadian campaign, because they look to us and, with the wonders of the internet, they look to our website and say, hey, these guys are doing this kind of work. We should be doing it in our country, in our community, too. And just this year, we had a campaign that started up in Malaysia and one in China.
What do you have to show?
The best tactic to demystify any myth is communication. I mean, getting the message out there consistently and persistently.
To God.
We've got some good people that are speaking out against this. They're speaking out against violence against women, speaking out against violence against sex workers. They're talking about these things, gender-based violence. There's people who are talking about me. The Trans Day of Remembrance on the 20th was a great example of people who have, been marginalized, have been pushed aside and taken out of public view, coming back in and saying, hey, this is what's happening. You have to deal with it. Like, this is happening next door to you. So you're responsible. You're responsible to be educated, and you're responsible to educate others. And that is the way that we start preventing this from happening.
And when your children see God? Do they have to be told of music on the radio? What are
the victims of the Montreal massacre at L'École Polytechnique on December 6, 1989? Geneviève Bergeron, Hélène Colga, Natalie Croutot, Barbara Daigneault, Anne-Marie Edward, Maud Havernick, Barbara Klujnik, Maryse Lagagnère, Maryse Leclerc, Anne-Marie LeMay, Sonia Pelletier, Michelle Richard, Annie Saint Arnaud, Annie Turcotte.
So how you gonna bring your children to God now that there's no lies left to tell?
This reflection on the Montreal massacre was produced for the CKUT Community News Collective by Aaron Lakoff, with files from Dykes on Mics and the National Film Board.
Who has come to stoke the fires of hell? Is it music on the radio? Or something in the water? No one really has to ask, why are children slaughtered?